Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. And today I'm joined by a writer, historian, adventurer, chef, painter, and illustrator. She's the author of a sprawling graphic memoir that covers nearly a century of Chinese history, seen through the lens of three generations of women. It's a story of her own family, of survival and madness and love. It's called Feeding Ghosts. And she'll be bringing her memoir to the Portland Book Festival on November 2nd. Tessa Hulls, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
So Tessa, let's talk about Feeding Ghosts. Early in the book, you give some hints about the title. There's a quote, you say, "In Chinese culture, there is a concept of hungry ghosts, where the spirits of people who did not accomplish what they needed to on Earth are doomed to eternally roam the planet with an insatiable appetite, trying to quell a starvation with no bottom."
Yeah, in my family, that concept of hungry ghosts was pretty literal. I grew up with my grandmother, Sun Yi, living in my nuclear family, and she had been a journalist in China, writing for pro-nationalist newspapers before the communists came to power. So once the People's Republic of China was founded in 1949, she found herself on the wrong side of history and was put through Maoist-era thought reform and essentially was subjected to 8 years of surveillance and forced to write false confessions such that it broke her mind. And so she and my mom eventually fled to Hong Kong and came to the US. So by the time I came around, she had been living within her own madness for decades. So I had a pretty literal hungry ghost in the form of my grandmother living in my nuclear family.
There wasn't much talk in your family. Obviously, you had your grandmother in the household and you dealt with her on a daily basis, but there wasn't much talk about this backstory. You said, my grandma lived with us, but as a child, I only knew three facts about her. One, she was from China. Two, she had once been a journalist, a famous author who wrote a best-selling memoir. Three, long ago, something happened and she lost her mind. And it was only around the time that you turned 30 in 2015 that you really started digging into the story.
Yeah, you know, I think there's a tendency for people who have experienced something firsthand to assume that everyone else has the same context that they do. And so for my mom, because she'd had a front row seat to what was happening in China and then my grandmother's collapse in Hong Kong, I don't think she really understood that for me, it was a locked box. And I kind of only saw the aftermath, not the accident that caused it. And I knew on some level that eventually I would have to tackle this story. But I think I also had a pretty good idea of how hard that was going to be and how much it was going to take. And I spent my 20s really running away. But in doing this book, I kind of came to reframe that and instead now see that I was gaining a strong enough foundation to be able to give a decade of my life to telling the story and not being consumed by it.
And it didn't help that there was a language barrier. Your grandmother had limited English, and you were never introduced to any of the Chinese languages that are difficult to learn. They're tonal, for one thing.
Yeah, I did try and learn in adulthood, and I can speak a little bit. But basically, within my family, my mom and grandma spoke Shanghainese, and we were in a town of 350, so there were literally no Asians I wasn't related to. So I made the choice to study Mandarin, because if you're learning in the US, it's basically you're learning Mandarin and you're learning Cantonese. And so my mom, as a polyglot, she speaks Shanghainese, Cantonese. She can understand Suzhou dialect and she can understand Mandarin, but not speak it. And so when for this book, I went and met my family for the first time, there actually wasn't a shared dialect that everyone could both speak and understand. And so my like 95-year-old great uncle was still sharp enough to be switching dialects so that we could all kind of at least mostly follow what was going on.
Yeah, you talk about going to China to meet your extended family, and they're off in the Suzhou area of China. And this was a trip you took with your mom. And that trip really changed your relationship with your mom as well as with your extended family.
I think growing up, my mom really didn't understand that there was no way for me to see where she had come from, and that a lot of the things that in context made a huge amount of sense seemed very out of place and jarring against a backdrop of rural America. And so the process of traveling to Hong Kong and China with my mother, it was really the first glimpse I'd ever had into who she was, sort of before my grandmother's breakdown had forced her to assume a caretaking role that she would hold for the rest of her life. And there is this one moment that I really strongly remember of, we were walking down the street and my mom saw a sugarcane vendor and she just tugged on my arm and she said, "Oh, Tessa, look, it's a sugarcane vendor. I used to love eating sugarcane." And just seeing my mom, these little flashes of her as an unguarded child, it really helped me feel so much more compassion for the sadness of what had happened to her and how much her own mother's trauma had really closed the window of possibility on what her own life could hold.
Well, you and your mom had very different approaches to expressing your emotions. And you refer to these two very different sides of your mother. You talk about her ghost twin.
It's a pretty common response for people who have gone through something really traumatic to just deny that anything has damaged them. And I think my mom was forced to be so responsible by every possible metric, which, you know, she did taking care of her own mother starting from when she was 10 years old, but then also in immigrating to the US, starting a family, bringing her mom over. And along the way, I think my mom just became so good at rigidly succeeding at the cost of having a connection to her own pain. But she instead sort of created the second self to house all of those things that she didn't know how to process or touch. And I called that her ghost twin. And it really would be like watching this cold mask come down over my mother's face when she touched on something that she, for her own emotional survival, needed to not acknowledge was there.
Right. You mentioned your mom's trauma. She was a child escaping Maoist China during the Great Leap Forward with her mother heading to Hong Kong. Let's back up a little bit, because the first part of the book helps set the scene with lots of history and family backstory. And you write about your grandparents having their first date in 1949 in Shanghai, something like, what, 3 days after the communists took over the city?
Kind of as it was happening. So the fall of Shanghai to the communists, it was the writing was on the wall. You know, the troops were coming in from further north and everyone sort of knew it was going to happen. And it was actually really anticlimactic on sort of the official takeover. And there are firsthand accounts of people kind of coming out of their houses and just seeing the People's Liberation Army politely sitting there, because there had been so much bloodshed previously that it actually just like kind of ended with a whimper, not a bang. So my mom was the result of my grandmother having a fling with a Swiss diplomat. And once she told him that she was pregnant, he never saw her again. And so that's an interesting point of my family story, is the intercession of this white man who disappeared still managed to have an extraordinarily strong downstream impact on pretty much everything that came to form my grandmother and my mother and my own life.
Yeah, and the story of feeding ghosts really centers on the women, because a lot of the male partners who are involved either go absent or they're just not totally invested.
Yeah, that was a question that when my editor and agent first read the outline that I'd written, they said, "Where are all the men?" And I just followed the thread of who ended up assuming responsibility. And so that negative space is really its own answer. And one of the most unexpected things to come from this research process was, because my unknown Swiss grandfather was a diplomat, and the Swiss, thank God, are very meticulous record keepers. So I was able to get a copy of his diplomatic dossier and learn that he also had attempted suicide and been committed to a mental institution. And through many degrees of sleuthing, I basically discovered that I have a whole half family in Switzerland and was able to make contact with them. And it turns out that my Swiss grandfather partially came to China because he was running away from another woman who he had impregnated and abandoned. And so it was really powerful and fascinating learning that my mom had an older half brother, and they actually met through this process and kind of bonded over the fact that they were both the result of this irresponsible, reckless man leaving a woman to clean up their mess.
Your grandmother finds a way into Hong Kong with your mom at 7 years old, and she writes this best-selling book that's kind of this scandalous tell-all. And you write that your grandmother was a deeply unreliable narrator.
It's really interesting because she was a journalist, and so she was deeply concerned with facts. And so my grandmother's memoir, which was titled 8 Years in Red Shanghai, Love, Starvation, Persecution. So, you know, she liked to be dramatic in her choice of language. But it was interesting because, you know, her life basically lined up with all of these major events in Chinese history, and she documented them to the day. And I was able to fact check all of that and have everything that she was saying confirmed by multiple other sources, other memoirs, other newspaper articles. And so what was interesting is that I think she was deeply trustworthy when it came to the historical facts. But the part where I think she took license was in how she portrayed herself as standing up to the Communist Party, because from everything that I've learned about that era, if she had really been talking back as much as she presents herself as having done, she would have been executed. And so I think that's where I have a little bit of skepticism towards the character she portrays herself as. And then additionally, my grandma wrote her book in this huge manic rush in only 3 months once she and my mom were in Hong Kong. And it was after that she had her first mental breakdown. And so looking back, it's very likely that that book was itself the beginning of this manifestation of her break from reality. So my mom and grandma fled to Hong Kong right after my mom turned 7. And basically once my grandmother wrote her book, it made her enough money that she could enroll my mom in this really prestigious boarding school, DGS, for 1 year. And part of my grandmother's mental breakdown was because her book ended up being pirated. She thought that she was going to be able to financially support herself, but instead she basically got paid for the advance and then never got anything else. So she had her breakdown. And at that point, my mom had been in this colonial boarding school where she was being taught by British expats and shamed if she ever spoke Chinese. And there was no money, but she was already one of them. And so they took her on as a charity case and supported her for the rest of her education while her mother was institutionalized. And my mom made the choice to not tell anyone about her mother's situation, because there was so much stigma around mental illness. And so nobody knew. And my mom was sneaking out on the weekends to go visit her mom in the mental hospital.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. And today we're talking with artist and writer Tessa Hulls. She's a painter, illustrator, and the author of the graphic memoir, Feeding Ghosts, about family secrets, madness, and survival during the Maoist upheaval in China. Tessa will be appearing at the Portland Book Festival at 2:15 p.m. on November 2nd, alongside Jessica Hoppe and Lupita Aquino. They'll be in the Portland Art Museum's Miller Gallery discussing ancestry, lineage, and debut memoirs. So Tessa, your art of choice is painting. Your artwork has been featured in a number of shows. You tend to use bright colors. In this book, you go into deep monochrome black and white.
It feels like a pretty apt metaphor for what the experience felt like. This book, it was really challenging to have to work with something this heavy for this long. And initially, I did want to do the book in color, but a huge part of teaching myself to draw comics was needing to unlearn the visual vocabulary that I had as a painter. And so I knew that what I was doing was I was like rendering too richly in a way that was really visually cluttered and chaotic. And so I knew that I had to take color away from myself, which again, like that's what this book felt like. It felt like having to walk away from all the color in the world to carry this story. And I think ultimately, as I became more fluent in the comics medium, a lot of the techniques and visual language that I did have as a painter started to sneak back in. And that's why the book has basically no blank white anywhere. I've had a couple people who have been reading it for interviews say that they had to use Post-its or colored pencils because there were no white spaces to write in.
Well, the art style is really effective for the material. It's got dark atmospheric panels that reminded me of some classic comic artists like Julie Doucet, Christina Critter, Richard Sala, Charles Burns, maybe a little bit of Edward Gorey.
Oh, I love Edward Gorey. That was a huge, huge influence. And actually, I have a great anecdote about my favorite ever homophone miscommunication. Is a lot of my friends are scientists, and I had a friend who was giving a talk, and he asked me if I would illustrate it. And this is when I was working down in Antarctica, and so we were talking on like a landline, and he asked if I would do a series of illustrations about scientists who had died in gory lab deaths or like were otherwise killed by their science. So like Marie Curie and radiation poisoning, there was like a guy who died in a walk-in centrifuge, stuff like that. And so I heard the word gory and I thought he meant in the style of Edward Gorey, whereas like he was meaning violent. And so I delivered all these to him and we realized this was the best miscommunication ever because I had drawn gory lab deaths in the style of Edward Gorey.
So like very poetic Victorian style deaths.
Yeah, it was a blast to illustrate. And yeah, the Charles Burns definitely was a big influence. Black Hole, I think you can see that that's one of the books I stared at a lot when teaching myself to draw comics.
Well, you did mention Antarctica, and you've traveled and worked all over the world from Alaska to Ghana to Antarctica. And Antarctica was where you taught yourself to draw comics. And I'm going to assume you can't bring quite as many art materials there.
Yeah, so the way that I, for many, many years, balanced the financial realities of being a working artist was by accidentally becoming a chef by way of playing college rugby. It's a long story. But I learned that you could take seasonal contracts as a cook. And so I was down at McMurdo Station working as a cook, and you work 6 days a week, 10 hours a day, which doesn't leave a lot of free time. And your first year there, you're kind of at the bottom of the housing lottery. And so I lived in a room with five other people and someone was always working night shifts. So the lights had to be off. And in order to work, I ended up making a little studio under my bed. And I wanted a way to really capture just the rich absurdities going on around me, and figured comics would be a really good way to capture some of the feel of just this wild, wild place. So yeah, that was my first foray into the medium.
Well, another way in which your painterly side expresses itself in this book, in Feeding Ghosts, is in the visual metaphors. You portray scenes with puppet shows, pinball machines, chess sets, water in its many forms.
Absolutely. I think that's why I chose to do this book as a graphic novel, is the way in which you can really subtly reinforce overarching points by having visual elements in the background that you're never completely spelling out for the reader. But I think the way in which I was trying to emphasize that there are all of these different layers, different patterns of movement, different sort of random ricochets that combine to form a story. There's a lot of visual elements that are basically saying that throughout. And then also because it was just such an incredibly depressing story to tell. Like I couldn't change the source material. Like I couldn't just pretend that it wasn't a story about like darkness and breaking minds. But what I did do sort of for my own sanity and emotional well-being while working on this is I had fun sneaking in references from my own childhood. So, you know, we've got the Royal Tenenbaums, the Little Mermaid, Rock'em Sock'em Robots, Viewfinders, things like that, where if you look closely, I think you can definitely tell that I was a child born in the mid-80s. And I also think there's something to the way in which the early touch points of your childhood and adolescence do become the framework through which you see the world. And I think that's a hallmark of mine, regardless of what medium I'm working in, is I'm sort of known for having really unexpected metaphors or lenses that at first sound really absurd. But once you actually follow the whole point that I'm making, they're very intentional.
Right. You really play around with the tropes, with the metaphors. So when you break free of your family in your 20s and, you know, your character in the book heads out into the wilderness, you portray yourself in Sergio Leone style Western garb. But then you deconstruct that cowboy myth and you talk a bit about the history of the Mexican vaquero.
Yeah. So a huge question that I'm asking throughout the book is, what are the stories we tell about ourselves? And as somebody with immigrant parents, my dad's from England, I think it was really interesting growing up in a very, very small town with not American parents, and therefore seeing the constant points of tension between the family system I was raised in and the larger culture in which we existed. And growing up also on the West Coast, the frontier myth is so integral to the story America tells about who we are. And I think it's really easy to romanticize. And now we're having a really necessary national conversation about what does it mean when your founding myth erases the violence that was required for it to be true. And so the book is a simultaneous deconstruction of the entire notion of what it means to be a cowboy on sort of a cultural and country level, but also what it means individually, where I use that metaphor to talk about how I, like my mother and grandmother, had basically closed myself off from my own emotions in order to survive the weight of the story, and realizing that I was walking towards the same fractured inability to have close relationships that defined both of them. And I was reading, you know, Jack London and Kerouac and Wallace Stegner and sort of all of these models of the cowboy, of you have your stoic square-jawed man who goes off into the wilderness to find himself. And I was really drawn to that. And it wasn't until later when I started turning a critical lens to kind of that whole like feral wilderness Western frontier canon that I began to really think, well, what does it mean if the text that sort of became your foundational mythology left no room for someone like you to exist? And that, I think, really was a question that began to work itself under my skin. And so coming back to tell the story of Feeding Ghosts and face this fissure within my family, I think part of it was really looking at what is the duty that we owe the systems that created us? And for me, I think the choice to be a cowboy would be like a very male choice to just walk away and say it's somebody else's thing to fix. And I think that's where being a woman and sort of telling the story of this repeated legacy of the women in my family picking up the pieces, this was a task I really felt I had to do, sort of in opposition to that cowboy myth.
So when you decided to dive into your family history, you went full bore. You didn't hold back. You had a translation made of your grandmother's book, which was still banned in China. And you brought a copy back to your extended family in Suzhou, along with your mom. You got a grant to go and do research in China. And you show up and you see this huge change in your mom as you meet up with your great auntie and great uncle and all these folks who your mom was just not allowed to communicate with for so long.
The process of this book, stitching my family back together, was really one of the most powerful things I have ever seen. And it was really the first time I had seen my mom outside of isolation. And it was the first time I had seen her just comfortably speaking her native language. Because for me, you know, the only person I'd ever heard her speak Shanghainese with was my grandmother. And that was a relationship of caretaking and codependence. And so something about just my mom at a table with our family, just smiling and laughing and talking, was revelatory.
Well, I want to go back to the visual metaphors. And one of the big ones is that the characters that you and your mom and your grandmother, the characters in the book are connected so many times by ribs or branches or vines. What were you going for with that visual?
For better or for worse, I think being an artist means just being more porous to inputs than the average bear. And there's a line that Aldous Huxley said, I think it was in Heaven and Hell, and he talks about the mind as a reducing valve. And it's basically something that allows you to tune out most of the world so that's more manageable. And I think artists are just people who have pretty poorly functioning limiting valves. And so for me, it's like, that's just what the world looks like. I feel it in my chest. I feel it in my ribs. I sometimes have to follow tendrils of light. And for me, these things just aren't metaphor. It's the somatic reality of the world that I inhabit. And so me drawing those is just, it's me drawing the world in the same way that I might draw a coffee table.
Well, tell us about the Chinese word for writer.
Yeah, so late in the game, I learned that the Chinese word for writer is suojia, and that the two characters, the first one is to make, and the second one is the character for family or home. And so to be a writer is to literally make family or home. And I just thought that that was the most apt description for what I was trying to do. And I think my mom and grandma really tried to do the same thing, but they did so without reckoning with this fissure in their past. And so in the book, I talk about this idea of my family is a broken bone that was never set right. And so kind of everything after my grandmother's first breakdown was growing around something that had fractured and recovered poorly. And therefore my job as a writer, as a zuojia, was to go back and re-break that fissure and then basically use this story to stitch that growth back together in a way that was healthy and whole.
So what's next for you?
As for what's next, I'm really interested in fusing my creative and wilderness lives. And I think what was so hard for me about making this book is it really took me out of engagement with the world for many, many years. And I am somebody who's very experiential. I like to be with other people. I like to be in the field. And I also want to work in a way where what I'm doing is of service. And what I want to do is become an embedded artist working with scientists who are doing field research around climate change and ecological resilience. And I basically want to pair with them for multiple years to be able to be their communication arm to talk about what they're doing and why it's important. Because I love scientists, but they are very, very bad at communicating with the broader world. And I essentially want to jump in as a comics journalist to shadow them and help be that bridge.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And my guest today has been Tessa Hulls. She's the author of the graphic memoir, Feeding Ghosts, which tells a turbulent story of Chinese history through the eyes of three generations of women. And she'll be appearing at the Portland Book Festival on November 2nd at 2:15 p.m. alongside Jessica Hoppe and Lupita Aquino. They'll be in the Portland Art Museum's Miller Gallery discussing ancestry, lineage, and debut memoirs. Tessa, it's been great talking with you today.
It's been a delight. Thank you so much for having me.
And for those listeners who might be interested in finding out more about your work, where would they look?
TessaHulls.com, or they could follow me on Instagram at TessaHulls. I'm glad to have a phonetic but unique last name.
Well, thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on social media at Words and Picture.